The Capitulation of King Leopold. King Leopold III of the Belgians surrendered early on the morning of May 28th. The headstrong young ruler, who had taken his country out of its alliance with France and Britain into a foolish neutrality, who had refused to restore the alliance even during the months when he knew the Germans were preparing a massive assault across his border, who at the last moment, after Hitler had struck, called on the French and British for military succor and received it, now deserted them in a desperate hour, opening the dike for German divisions to pour through on the flank of the sorely pressed Anglo-French troops. Moreover, he did it, as Churchill told the Commons on June 4th, without prior consultation, with the least possible notice, without the advice of his ministers, and upon his own personal act. Actually, he did it against the unanimous advice of his government, which he was constitutionally sworn to follow. At 5 a.m. on May 25th, there was a showdown meeting at the King's headquarters between the monarch and three members of the cabinet, including the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. They urged him for the last time not to surrender personally and become a prisoner of the Germans, for if he did, he would be degraded to the role of Hacke in Prague. They also reminded him that he was head of state as well as commander-in-chief, and that if matters came to the worst, he could exercise his first office in exile, as the Queen of Holland and the King of Norway had decided to do, until eventual Allied victory came. "I have decided to stay," Leopold answered. "The cause of the Allies is lost." At 5 p.m. on May 27th, he dispatched General de Rousseau, deputy chief of the Belgian General Staff, to the Germans to ask for a truce. At 10 o'clock, the general brought back the German terms. "The Führer demands that arms be laid down unconditionally." The king accepted unconditional surrender at 11 p.m. and proposed that fighting cease at 4 a.m., which it did. Leopold's capitulation was angrily denounced by Premier Reynaud of France in a violent broadcast, and Belgian Premier Pierlot, also broadcasting from Paris but in a more dignified tone, informed the Belgian people that the king had acted against the unanimous advice of the government, broken his links with the people, and was no longer in a position to govern, and that the Belgian government in exile would continue the struggle. Churchill, when he spoke in the House on May 28th, reserved judgment on Leopold's action, but on June 4th joined in the general criticism. The controversy raged long after the war was over. Leopold's defenders, and there were many in and outside Belgium, believed that he had done the right and honorable thing in sharing the fate of his soldiers and of the Belgian people. And they made much of the claim that the king acted not as chief of state, but as commander-in-chief of the Belgian army in surrendering. That the battered Belgian troops were in desperate straits by May 27th, there is no dispute. Valiantly, they had agreed to extend their front in order to free the British and French to fight their way south, and that extended front was fast collapsing, though the Belgians fought doggedly. Also, Leopold was not told that on May 26th, Lord Gort had received orders from London to withdraw to Dunkirk and save what he could of the BEF. That is one side of the argument, but there is another. The Belgian army was under the overall Allied command, and Leopold made a separate peace without consulting it. In his defense, it has been pointed out that on May 27th at 12:30 p.m., he telegraphed Gort that he soon would be forced to capitulate to avoid a collapse. But the British commander, who was extremely busy and constantly on the move, did not receive it. He later testified that he first heard of the surrender only shortly after 11 p.m. on May 27th and found himself suddenly faced with an open gap of 20 miles between Ypres and the sea through which enemy armored forces might reach the beaches. To General Weygand, who was the king's superior military commander, the news arrived by telegram from French liaison at Belgian headquarters a little after 6 p.m., and it hit him, he later said, like a bolt out of the blue. There had been no warning. Finally, even as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Leopold, in this constitutional democratic monarchy, was bound to accept the advice of his government. Neither in that role nor certainly as chief of state did he have the authority to surrender on his own. In the end, the Belgian people, as was proper, passed judgment on their sovereign. He was not recalled to the throne from Switzerland, where he took refuge at the war's end, until 5 years after it was over, when the call came on July 20th, 1950, after 57% of those voting in a referendum had approved it, His return provoked such a violent reaction among the populace that civil war threatened to break out. He soon abdicated in favor of his son. Whatever may be said of Leopold's behavior, there should be no dispute, though there has been, from, among others, General Sir Alan Brooke, who commanded the British Second Corps and later became Field Marshal Lord Alan Brooke, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, see Sir Arthur Bryant, The Turn of the Tide, based on Alan Brooke's diaries, about the magnificent way his army fought. For a few days in May, I followed Reichenau's Sixth Army through Belgium and saw for myself the tenacity with which the Belgians struggled against insuperable odds. Not once did they break under the unmerciful and unopposed bombing of the Luftwaffe or when the German armor tried to cut through them. This could not be said of certain other Allied troops in that campaign. The Belgians held out for 18 days and would have held out much longer had not they, like the BEF and the French Northern Armies, been caught in a trap which was not of their making. Miracle at Dunkirk. Ever since May 20th, when Guderian's tanks broke through to Abbeville on the sea, the British Admiralty, on the personal orders of Churchill, had been rounding up shipping for a possible evacuation of the BEF and other Allied forces from the Channel ports. Non-combatant personnel and other useless mouths began to be ferried across the narrow sea to England at once. By May 24th, as we have seen, the Belgian front to the north was near collapse, and to the south, the German armor, striking up the coast from Abbeville, after taking Boulogne and enveloping Calais, had reached the Ah Canal only 20 miles from Dunkirk. In between were caught the Belgian army, the 9 divisions of the BEF, and 10 divisions of the French First Army. Though the terrain on the southern end of the pocket was bad tank country, being crisscrossed with canals, ditches, and flooded areas, Guderian's and Reinhardt's panzer corps already had 5 bridgeheads across the main barrier, the Ah Canal, between Gravelines on the sea and Saint-Omer, and were poised for the knockout blow, which would hammer the Allied armies against the anvil of the advancing German 6th and 18th armies pushing down from the northeast, and utterly destroy them. Suddenly, on the evening of May 24th, came the peremptory order from the High Command, issued at the insistence of Hitler with the prompting of Rundstedt and Göring, but over the violent objections of Brauchitsch and Halder, that the tank forces should halt on the canal line and attempt no further advance. This furnished Lord Gort an unexpected and vital reprieve which he and the British Navy and Air Force made the most of, and which, as Rundstedt later perceived and said, led to one of the great turning points of the war. How did this inexplicable stop order on the threshold of what seemed certain to be the greatest German victory of the campaign come about? What were the reasons for it, and who was responsible? The questions have provoked one of the greatest arguments of the war, among the German generals involved and among the historians. The generals, led by Rundstedt and Halder, have put the blame exclusively on Hitler. Churchill added further fuel to the controversy in the second volume of his war memoirs by contending that the initiative for the order came from Rundstedt and not Hitler, and citing as evidence the war diaries of Rundstedt's own headquarters. In the maze of conflicting and contradictory testimony, it has been difficult to ascertain the facts. In the course of preparing this chapter, the author wrote General Halder himself for further elucidation and promptly received a courteous and detailed reply. On the basis of this and much other evidence now in, certain conclusions may be drawn and the controversy settled, if not conclusively, at least fairly convincingly. As for responsibility for the famous order, Rundstedt, despite his later assertions to the contrary, must share it with Hitler. The Führer visited the General's Army Group A headquarters at Charleville on the morning of May 24th. Rundstedt proposed that the panzer divisions on the canal line before Dunkirk be halted until more infantry could be brought up. This fact, established from the records of Rundstedt's own headquarters, did not prevent the general from making several statements after the war which put the blame entirely on Hitler. "If I had had my way," he told Major Milton Schulman, a Canadian intelligence officer, "the English would not have got off so lightly at Dunkirk, but my hands were tied by direct orders from Hitler himself. While the English were clambering into the ships off the beaches, I was kept uselessly outside the port, unable to move. I sat outside the town, watching the English escape while my tanks and infantry were prohibited from moving. This incredible blunder was due to Hitler's personal idea of generalship. Schulman, Defeat in the West, pages 42 to 43. To a commission of the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg on June 20, 1946, mimeographed transcript, page 1490, Rundstedt added, "That was a very big mistake of the commander. How angry we leaders were at that time is indescribable." Rundstedt made similar declarations to Little Hart, The German General's Talk, pages 112 to 113, and to the Nuremberg Military Tribunal in the trial of United States versus Leib, pages 3350 to 3353 and 3931 to 3932 of the mimeographed transcript. Telford Taylor in The March of Conquest and Major L.F. Ellis in The War in France and Flanders, 1939-40, have analyzed the German Army records of the incident and drawn conclusions that somewhat differ. Ellis's book is the official British account of the campaign and contains both British and German documents. Taylor, who spent 4 years as an American prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, is an authority on the German documents. Hitler agreed with Rundstedt, observing that the armor should be conserved for later operations against the French south of the Somme. Moreover, he declared that if the pocket in which the Allies were entrapped became too small, it would hamper the activities of the Luftwaffe. Probably Rundstedt, with the approval of the Führer, issued the stop order at once, for Churchill notes that the BEF intercepted a German radio message giving orders to that effect at 11:42 that morning. Hitler and Rundstedt were at that moment in conference. At any rate, that evening Hitler issued the formal order from OKW, both Jodl and Halder noting it in their diaries. The General Staff Chief was most unhappy. "Our left wing, consisting of armor and motorized forces," he wrote in his diary, "will thus be stopped dead in its tracks on the direct orders of the Führer. Finishing off the encircled enemy army is to be left to the Air Force." This exclamation mark of contempt indicates that Goering had intervened with Hitler, and it is now known that he did. He offered to liquidate the entrapped enemy troops with his air force alone. The reasons for his ambitious and vain proposal were given the writer in a letter from Halder on July 19, 1957. During the following days, that is after May 24th, it became known that Hitler's decision was mainly influenced by Goering. To the dictator, the rapid movement of the army, whose risks and prospects of success he did not understand because of his lack of military schooling, became almost sinister. He was constantly oppressed by a feeling of anxiety that a reversal loomed. Goering, who knew his Führer well, took advantage of this anxiety. He offered to fight the rest of the great battle of encirclement alone with his Luftwaffe, thus eliminating the risk of having to use the valuable panzer formations. He made this proposal for a reason which was characteristic of the unscrupulously ambitious Goering. He wanted to secure for his Air Force, after the surprisingly smooth operations of the army up to then, the decisive final act in the great battle, and thus gain the glory of success before the whole world. General Halder then tells in his letter of an account given him by Brauchitsch after a talk which the latter had with the Luftwaffe generals Milch and Kesselring in Nuremberg jail in January 1946. In which the Air Force officers declared that Goering at that time, May 1940, emphasized to Hitler that if the great victory in battle then developing could be claimed exclusively by the army generals, the prestige of the Führer in the German homeland would be damaged beyond repair. That could be prevented only if the Luftwaffe and not the army carried out the decisive battle. It is fairly clear, then, that Hitler's idea, prompted by Goering and Rundstedt but strenuously opposed by Brauchitsch and Halder, was to let the Air Force and Bach's Army Group B, which, without any armor to speak of, was slowly driving back the Belgians and British southwest of the Channel, mop up the enemy troops in the pocket. Rundstedt's Army Group A, with some 7 tank divisions, halted on the water lines west and south of Dunkirk, would merely stand pat and keep the enemy hemmed in. But neither the Luftwaffe nor Bach's Army Group proved able to achieve their objectives. On the morning of May 26th, Halder was fuming in his diary that these orders from the top just make no sense. The tanks are stopped as if they were paralyzed. Finally, on the evening of May 26th, Hitler rescinded the stop order and agreed that, in view of Bach's slow advance in Belgium and the movement of transports off the coast, the armored forces could resume their advance on Dunkirk. By then it was late. The cornered enemy had had time to strengthen his defenses, and behind them was beginning to slip away to sea. We now know that there were political reasons, too, for Hitler's fatal order. Halder had noted in his diary on May 25th, a day, he says, that started off with one of those painful wrangles between Brauchitsch and the Führer on the next moves in the Battle of Encirclement, that now political command has formed the fixed idea that the Battle of Decision must not be fought on Flemish soil, but rather in northern France. This entry puzzled me, and when I wrote to the former General Staff Chief, I asked him if he could recall Hitler's political reasons for wanting to finish this battle in northern France rather than in Belgium. Halder recalled them very well. "According to my still quite lively memory," he replied, "Hitler, in our talks at the time, supported his reasons for the stop order with two main lines of thought. The first were military reasons, the unsuitable nature of the terrain for tanks, the resulting high losses, which would weaken the impending attack on the rest of France, and so on. Then," writes Halder, "the Führer cited a second reason, which he knew that we as soldiers could not argue against, since it was political and not military. This second reason was that for political reasons he did not want the decisive final battle, which inevitably would cause great damage to the population, to take place in territory inhabited by the Flemish people. He had the intention, he said, of making an independent National Socialist region out of the territory inhabited by the German-descended Flemish, thereby binding them close to Germany. His supporters on Flemish soil had been active in this direction for a long time. He had promised them to keep their land free from the damage of war. If he did not keep this promise now, their confidence in him would be severely damaged. That would be a political disadvantage for Germany, which he, as the politically responsible leader, must avoid." Absurd? If this seems to be another of Hitler's sudden aberrations, Halder writes that he and Brauchitsch were not convinced by this reasoning. Other political consideration, which he confided to other generals, were more sane and important. Describing after the war Hitler's meeting with Rundstedt on May 24th, General Günter Blumentritt, the latter's chief of operations, told Little Hart, the British military writer, "Hitler was in very good humor and gave us his opinion that the war would be finished in 6 weeks. After that, he wished to conclude a reasonable peace with France, and then the way would be free for an agreement with Britain. He then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and of the civilization that Britain had brought into the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. The return of Germany's colonies would be desirable, but not essential. He concluded by saying that his aim was to make peace with Britain on a basis that she would regard as compatible with her honor to accept." Such thoughts Hitler was to express often during the next few weeks to his generals, to Ciano and Mussolini, and finally in public. Ciano was astonished a month later to find the Nazi dictator, then at the zenith of his success, harping about the importance of maintaining the British Empire as a factor in world equilibrium. And on July 13th, Halder, in his diary, described the Führer as sorely puzzled over Britain's failure to accept peace. "To bring England to her knees by force," he told his generals that day, "would not benefit Germany, only Japan, the United States, and others." It may be, then, though some doubt it, that Hitler restrained his armored forces before Dunkirk in order to spare Britain a bitter humiliation and thereby facilitate a peace settlement. It would have to be, as he said, a peace in which the British left Germany free to turn once more eastward, this time against Russia. London would have to recognize, as he also said, the Third Reich's domination of the continent. For the next couple of months, Hitler would be confident that such a peace was within his grasp. No more now than in all the years before did he comprehend the character of the British nation or the kind of world its leaders and its people were determined to fight for, to the end. Nor did he and his generals, ignorant of the sea as they were, and remained, dream that the sea-minded British could evacuate a third of a million men from a small battered port and from the exposed beaches right under their noses. At 3 minutes before seven on the evening of May 26th, shortly after Hitler's stop order had been cancelled, the British Admiralty signaled the beginning of Operation Dynamo, as the Dunkirk evacuation was called. That night, the German armor resumed its attack on the port from the west and south, but now the panzers found it hard going. Lord Gort had had time to deploy against them 3 infantry divisions with heavy artillery support. The tanks made little progress. In the meantime, the evacuation began. An armada of 850 vessels of all sizes, shapes, and methods of propulsion, from cruisers and destroyers to small sailboats and Dutch scouts, many of them manned by civilian volunteers from the English coastal towns, converged on Dunkirk. The first day, May 27th, they took off 7,669 troops. The next day, 17,804. The following day, 47,310. And on May 30th, 53,823, for a total of 126,606 during the first 4 days. This was far more than the Admiralty had hoped to get out. When the operation began, it counted on evacuating only about 45,000 men in the 2 days' time it then thought it would have. It was not until this 4th day of Operation Dynamo, on May 30th, that the German High Command woke up to what was happening. For 4 days, the communiques of OKW had been reiterating that the encircled enemy armies were doomed. A communique of May 29th, which I noted in my diary, stated flatly, "The fate of the French army in Artois is sealed. The British army, which has been compressed into the territory around Dunkirk, is also going to its destruction before our concentric attack." But it wasn't. It was going to sea. Without its heavy arms and equipment, to be sure, but with the certainty that the men would live to fight another day. As late as the morning of May 30th, Halder confided confidentially in his diary that "the disintegration of the enemy which we have encircled continues." Some of the British, he conceded, were fighting with tooth and nail. The others were fleeing to the coast and trying to get across the channel on anything that floats. "Le débâcle," he concluded, alluding to Zola's famous novel of the French collapse in the Franco-Prussian War. By afternoon, after a session with Brauchitsch, the general staff chief had awakened to the significance of the swarms of miserable little boats on which the British were fleeing. "Brauchitsch is angry. The pocket would have been closed to the coast if only our armor had not been held back. The bad weather has grounded the Luftwaffe, and we must now stand by and watch countless thousands of the enemy get away to England right under our noses." That was, in fact, what they watched. Despite increased pressure, which was immediately applied by the Germans on all sides of the pocket, the British lines held, and more troops were evacuated. The next day, May 31st, was the biggest day of all. Some 68,000 men were embarked for England, a third of them from the beaches, the rest from the Dunkirk harbor. A total of 194,620 men had now been taken out, more than 4 times the number originally hoped for. Where was the famed Luftwaffe? Part of the time, as Halder noted, it was grounded by bad weather. The rest of the time it encountered unexpected opposition from the Royal Air Force, which from bases just across the channel successfully challenged it for the first time. A good many of the exhausted Tommies on the beaches, who underwent severe bombings, were not aware of this, since the air clashes were often above the clouds or some distance away. They knew only that they had been bombed and strafed all the way back from eastern Belgium to Dunkirk, and they felt their air force had let them down. When they reached the home ports, some of them insulted men in the blue RAF uniforms. Churchill was much aggrieved at this and went out of his way to put them right when he spoke in the House on June 4th. "The deliverance at Dunkirk," he said, "was gained by the Air Force." Though outnumbered, the new British Spitfires proved more than a match for the Messerschmitts, and they mowed down the cumbersome German bombers. On a few occasions, Goering's planes arrived over Dunkirk between British sorties and did such extensive damage to the port that for a time it was unusable and the troops had to be lifted exclusively from the beaches. The Luftwaffe also pressed several strong attacks on the shipping and accounted for most of the 243 out of 861 vessels sunk. But it failed to achieve what Goering had promised Hitler, the annihilation of the BEF. On June 1st, when it carried out its heaviest attack and suffered its heaviest losses, each side lost 30 planes, sinking 3 British destroyers and a number of small transports, the second highest day's total was evacuated, 64,429 men. By dawn of the next day, only 4,000 British troops remained in the perimeter, protected by 100,000 French who now manned the defenses. Medium German artillery had in the meantime come within range, and daytime evacuation operations had to be abandoned. The Luftwaffe at that time did not operate after dark, and during the nights of June 2nd and 3rd, the remainder of the BEF and 60,000 French troops were successfully brought out. Dunkirk, still defended stubbornly by 40,000 French soldiers, held out until the morning of June 4th. By that day, 338,226 British and French soldiers had escaped the German clutches. They were no longer an army. Most of them, understandably, were for the moment in a pitiful shape. But they were battle-tried. They knew that if properly armed and adequately covered from the air, they could stand up to the Germans. Most of them, when the balance in armament was achieved, would prove it, and on beaches not far down the Channel coast from where they had been rescued. A deliverance Dunkirk was to the British, but Churchill reminded them in the House on June 4th that wars are not won by evacuations. The predicament of Great Britain was indeed grim, more dangerous than it had been since the Norman landings nearly a millennium before. It had no army to defend the islands. The Air Force had been greatly weakened in France. Only the Navy remained, and the Norwegian campaign had shown how vulnerable the big fighting ships were to land-based aircraft. Now the Luftwaffe bombers were based but 5 or 10 minutes away across the narrow channel. France, to be sure, still held out below the Somme and the Aisne. But its best troops and armament had been lost in Belgium and in northern France. Its small and obsolescent air force had been largely destroyed, and its two most illustrious generals, Marshal Pétain and General Weygand, who now began to dominate the shaky government, had no more stomach for battle against such a superior foe. These dismal facts were very much on the mind of Winston Churchill when he rose in the House of Commons on June 4, 1940, while the last transports from Dunkirk were being unloaded, determined, as he wrote later, to show not only his own people but the world, and especially the USA, that our resolve to fight on was based on serious grounds. It was on this occasion that he uttered his famous peroration, which will be long remembered and will surely rank with the greatest ever made down the ages. Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight in the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle, until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. The collapse of France. The determination of the British to fight on does not seem to have troubled Hitler's thoughts. He was sure they would see the light after he had finished off France, which he now proceeded to do. The morning after Dunkirk fell on June 5th, the Germans launched a massive assault on the Somme, and soon they were attacking in overwhelming strength all along a 400-mile front that stretched across France from Abbeville to the Upper Rhine. The French were doomed. Against 143 German divisions, including 10 armored, they could deploy only 65 divisions, most of them second rate, for the best units and most of the armor had been expended in Belgium. Little was left of the weak French air force. The British could contribute but one infantry division, which had been in the Saar, and parts of an armored division. The RAF could spare few planes for this battle unless it were to leave the British Isles themselves defenseless. Finally, the French High Command, now dominated by Pétain and Weygand, had become sodden with defeatism. Nevertheless, some French units fought with great bravery and tenacity, temporarily stopping even the German armor here and there, and standing up resolutely to the incessant pounding of the Luftwaffe. But it was an unequal struggle. In victorious confusion, as Telford Taylor has aptly put it, the German troops surged across France like a tidal wave, the confusion coming because there were so many of them and they were moving so fast and often getting in each other's way. On June 10th, the French government hastily departed Paris, and on June 14th, the great city, the glory of France, which was undefended, was occupied by General von Kukler's 18th Army. The swastika was immediately hoisted on the Eiffel Tower. On June 16th, Premier Reynaud, whose government had fled to Bordeaux, resigned and was replaced by Pétain, who the next day asked the Germans through the Spanish ambassador for an armistice. On this day, June 17, 1940, the exiled Kaiser sent from Doorn in occupied Holland a telegram of congratulations to Hitler, whom he had for so long scorned as a vulgar upstart. It was found among the captured Nazi papers. Under the deeply moving impression of the capitulation of France, I congratulate you and the whole German Wehrmacht on the mighty victory granted by God. In the words of the Emperor Wilhelm the Great in 1870, what a turn of events brought about by divine dispensation. In all German hearts there echoes the Leuthen chorale sung by the victors of Leuthen, the soldiers of the great king. Now thank we all our God. Hitler, who believed that the mighty victory was due more to himself than to God, drafted a restrained reply, but whether it was ever sent is not indicated in the documents. The Führer had been furious a little earlier when he learned that a German unit which overran Doorn had posted a guard of honor around the exiled emperor's residence. Hitler ordered the guard removed and Doorn posted as out of bounds to all German soldiers. Wilhelm II died at Doorn on June 4, 1941, and was buried there. His death, Hassel noted in his diary, page 200, went almost unnoticed in Germany. Hitler and Goebbels saw to that. Hitler replied to Pétain the same day that he would first have to consult with his ally Mussolini. For this strutting warrior, after making sure that the French armies were hopelessly beaten, had, like a jackal, hopped into the war on June 10th to try to get in on the spoils. The Duce plunges his small dagger into France's back. Despite his preoccupation with the unfolding of the Battle of the West, Hitler had found time to write Mussolini at surprisingly frequent intervals, keeping him informed of the mounting German victories. After the first letter on May 7th, apprising the Duce that he was attacking Belgium and Holland to ensure their neutrality, and saying he would keep his friend informed of his progress so that the Duce could make his own decisions in time, there were further ones on May 13th, 18th, and 25th, each more detailed and enthusiastic than the other. Though the generals, as Halder's diary confirms, couldn't have cared less what Italy did, whether it came into the war or not, the Führer, for some reason, attached importance to Italian intervention. As soon as the Netherlands and Belgium had surrendered and the Anglo-French northern armies had been smashed, and the surviving British troops began taking to the boats at Dunkirk, Mussolini decided to slither into the war. He informed Hitler by letter on May 30th that the date would be June 5th. Hitler replied immediately that he was most profoundly moved. If there could still be anything which could strengthen my unshakable belief in the victorious outcome of this war, Hitler wrote on May 31st, it was your statement. The mere fact of your entering the war is an element calculated to deal the front of our enemies a staggering blow. The Führer asked his ally, however, to postpone his date for 3 days. He wanted to knock out the rest of the French Air Force first, he said, and Mussolini obliged by setting it back 5 days to June 10th. Hostilities, the Duce said, would begin the following day. They did not amount to much. By June 18th, when Hitler summoned his junior partner to Munich to discuss an armistice with France, some 32 Italian divisions, after a week of fighting, had been unable to budge a scanty French force of 6 divisions on the Alpine front and farther south along the Riviera, though the defenders were now threatened by assault in the rear from the Germans sweeping down the Rhone Valley. The defeatist French High Command forbade any offensive action against Italy. On June 14th, a French naval squadron bombarded factories, oil tanks, and refineries near Genoa, but Admiral Darlan prohibited any further action of this kind. When the RAF tried to send bombers from the airfield at Marseille to attack Milan and Turin, the French drove trucks onto the field and prevented the planes from taking off. On June 21st, Ciano noted in his diary, Mussolini is quite humiliated because our troops have not moved a step forward. Even today they have not succeeded in advancing, and have halted in front of the first French fortification, which put up some resistance. The hollowness of Mussolini's boasted military might was exposed at the very beginning, and this put the deflated Italian dictator in a dour mood as he and Ciano set out by train on the evening of June 17th to confer with Hitler about the armistice with France. "Mussolini dissatisfied," Ciano wrote in his diary. "This sudden peace disquiets him. During the trip, we speak at length in order to clarify conditions under which the armistice is to be granted to the French. The Duce would like to go so far as the total occupation of French territory and demands the surrender of the French fleet, but he is aware that his opinion has only a consultative value. The war has been won by Hitler without any active military participation on the part of Italy, and it is Hitler who will have the last word. This naturally disturbs and saddens Mussolini." The mildness of the Führer's last word came as a distinct shock to the Italians when they conferred with the Nazi warlord at the Führerhaus at Munich, where Chamberlain and Daladier had been so accommodating to the two dictators regarding Czechoslovakia less than 2 years before. The secret German memorandum of the meeting makes clear that Hitler was determined above all not to allow the French fleet to fall into the hands of the British. He was also concerned lest the French government flee to North Africa or to London and continue the war. For that reason, the armistice terms, the final terms of peace might be something else, would have to be moderate, designed to keep a French government functioning on French soil and the French fleet neutralized. He abruptly dismissed Mussolini's demands for the Italian occupation of the Rhone Valley, including Toulon, the great French Mediterranean naval base where most of the fleet was concentrated, and Marseille, and the disarmament of Corsica, Tunisia, and Djibouti. The last town, the gateway to Italian-held Ethiopia, was thrown in by Ciano, the German notes say, in an undertone. Even the bellicose Ribbentrop, Ciano found, was exceptionally moderate and calm, and in favor of peace. The warrior Mussolini was very much embarrassed, his son-in-law noted. He feels that his role is secondary. In truth, the Duce fears that the hour of peace is growing near, and sees fading once again that unattainable dream of his life, glory on the field of battle. Mussolini was unable even to get Hitler to agree to joint armistice negotiations with the French. The Führer was not going to share his triumph at a very historic spot, he declined to name it to his friend, with this Johnny-come-lately. But he promised the Duce that his armistice with France would not come into effect until the French had also signed one with Italy. Mussolini left Munich bitter and frustrated, but Ciano had been very favorably impressed by a side of Hitler which his diaries make clear he had not previously seen or suspected. "From all that he, Hitler, says," he wrote in his diary as they returned to Rome, "it is clear that he wants to act quickly to end it all. Hitler is now the gambler who has made a big scoop and would like to get up from the table, risking nothing more. Today he speaks with a reserve and a perspicacity which, after such a victory, are really astonishing. I cannot be accused of excessive tenderness toward him, but today I truly admire him."